I'm Brett Walton, moderator here. I write for Circle of Blue. We're a news agency that reports on water issues. This panel is Water in a Time of Scarcity, responding to drought. And drought, as every Californian knows and many other people across the country, it changes everything. So lakes shrink, ski resort operators lay off employees, fish suffer, wildfires and air pollution worsen, wells go dry, a whole range of issues cascade from a lack of water. And today we're going to focus on the response. What are people doing to respond to these changes in water availability and timing? We have an all-star panel here today to help us talk through some of these responses and what people across the state are doing and what they're learning that might be applicable to other people in the country. I'll briefly introduce the panelists. Full bios are available in the conference app and on the website for the conference. To my left, we have Nadine Bailey. She's the Chief Operations Officer for the Family Water Alliance. Then we have Brian Stranko, who's the California Water Program Director for the Nature Conservancy. Then we have Nusha Jami. She's the Director of Urban Water Policy, Stanford University. Then we have, filling in for Martin Adams, whose name is in your program, we have David Pettijohn, who's the Director of Water Resources at Los Angeles Department of Water and Power. So I'll direct the first question down at the end of the panel to David. Los Angeles, biggest city in California. How has this drought changed how you look at water and what you're doing for water supply?
Well, it's been a pretty dramatic effort in Los Angeles, actually, and it has changed the way we look at water somewhat, but the city of Los Angeles has taken water use efficiency and water conservation pretty seriously for a long time. So I'll tell you a little about the past, and I'll tell you about some of the present things that we are currently doing to respond to this drought, and then some of the future efforts that we're taking. So the past. So if you look back to 1970, in the city of L.A., we had 2.8 million residents living in the city. At the time, we were using about 600,000 acre-feet of water. Now, for those of you who don't know what an acre-foot of water is, you know what a football field is. If you cover a football field, including the end zones, with a foot of water, that's an acre-foot of water. So in 1970, a column of water that covered a football field that went up into the sky 600,000 feet. Now, considering an airliner flies 20 to 30,000 feet, you can imagine the amount of water we deliver every year. But that's what we did in 1970. So you fast forward to 2015, the population of Los Angeles is 4 million people. Well, we actually use less water than we did in 1970. We used 514,000 acre feet of water last year. So actually less. Well, that also translates into one of the lowest gallons per capita per day use of any large city in the United States. In fact, any city over a million people in the United States, we're the lowest per capita water use. We're at 104 gallons per person per day in Los Angeles. And that's the all-in number, includes residential use, commercial use, all unaccounted water, water loss in the system. It's an all-in number. So pretty low. So that's essentially what our track record has been. So what did we do during this drought? We took some pretty aggressive actions. Actually, we doubled our outreach budget. So, you know, when you're in a drought, really the thing that you can do fairly quickly is behavior modification. So we had about a $2 million budget every year for outreach. We doubled that to $4 million to kick up the behavior change. We also instituted new green building codes. So these building codes essentially mandated water use efficiency for various devices, but it also mandated sub-metering for residential multifamily dwellings. So if the building's less than three stories and it has more than 50 units, you've got to submeter that building. And in the old days, there are no submeters on multifamily residential. So, you know, customers tend to waste water that way. We instituted a rate increase, a five-year rate increase, about 3% a year. For the next 5 years, water rates are going to go up. We went from a two-tier rate structure to a four-tier rate structure. Our old rate structure, the first tier was $5, second tier was $6, not much of a real signal to the customer. Now the first tier actually went down. It's $4.50, and the highest tier is $8. So quite a signal here in four different tiers. We also did something that's pretty unique for water agencies in California. We did what's called decoupling in our water rates, and that means that we set a revenue requirement. And if you overcollect from that revenue requirement in the following year, the customers get a break in their rates. If you undercollect due to drought or you're hitting conservation really hard in the following year, your rates automatically adjust up. So when you go into scarcity, you can really hit conservation, water use efficiency messages and incentives really hard, and you don't erode your revenue stream. We went to phase two of our emergency water conservation ordinance in the city, and that has a whole list of prohibited uses. Simple things like fixing leaks, not watering between 9 and 4 p.m., not allowing water to run off your property, not irrigating during rain, just simple common sense things. We also instituted three-day-a-week watering in the city. We also enforced that accord. You know, there are a lot of cities around the state that have restrictions on water use and prohibitions, but they don't enforce it. We do. For instance, this last year, we've got about 14,000 complaints that people are wasting water. We've investigated those, and 99% of the time, people are responsive to our investigations, and they just comply. But we've only had to issue 75 fines with 14,000 reports of waste. So it's a pretty good record of people in Los Angeles. We have very extensive lists of rebates and incentives we offer on all kinds of indoor and outdoor water using devices in the city. Since 1990, we've spent about $350 million on those. And we've conserved hardware-based installed conservation, about 105,000 acre-feet a year with that investment. We've done for the first time, a comprehensive water loss audit and component analysis in the city in response to this drought. We have an excessive water use ordinance for the first time, and this is going to target those water users who are in Tier 4 that are our highest water users. We're going to give them a budget, and they've got to comply with that budget. And if they don't, the fines can be pretty severe. If the city is in Phase 5 of its emergency ordinance and you're still violating for 24 months, you can end up with a monthly fine of $40,000. So even the richest people in Los Angeles are going to have a signal to them if they're wasting water. In the future, we do have plans in the city. The mayor just adopted a sustainable city plan. Inside that plan, it has goals for water use for the city, 20% additional reductions in water use by 2017, a reduction in purchased imported water into the city by 50% by 2025, and a requirement that we source all of the water that the city uses locally by 2035. So pretty aggressive goals. We have got plans to reach those goals. Those are all found in our 2015 Urban Water Management Plan. And we have a track record on how to get to each one of those goals. We did a stormwater capture master plan, so we're going to have stormwater part of it. We also put out a conservation potential study that we're finalizing now, and then a recycle water master plan. So kind of a capture, conserve, reuse policy to address those goals. So that's kind of past, present, and future. And, you know, any of those things I talked about that you want to drill into a little more, we can during the Q&A.
Okay. Thanks, David. We'll go into more of the longer-term supply planning a bit later. I want to turn to Nadine here. You live in a different part of the state. You're up here in the Sacramento Valley. You represent rural and agricultural communities. Can you say a bit about how the drought looks different from your perspective and what might be different in your response from, say, Los Angeles?
Well,
turn the mic on.
It was interesting to hear him say that they started conserving water in Los Angeles. So from my perspective, the minute that Los Angeles had to start conserving is when they started beating up on farmers for using water on crops. All we heard was that we were wasting water. So it's an interesting problem that we have here that people don't understand what is going on in the agricultural community. North of here, you're sitting at the very tip bottom of the Sacramento Valley. You go north. It took me about 2.5 hours to drive down here. So you drive north towards Mount Shasta, and you will see the mountains that provide about 70% of the water that's used in California come out of this giant bowl that's called the Sacramento Valley. So in addition to providing the water for the rest of the state through the Sacramento Valley Project, we also provide for a lot of fisheries that start here. The main spawning beds for the salmon fisheries start up where I live in Redding. And so those cold water pools, that was one of the biggest impacts on us, is when the drought happened and the tributaries to the Sacramento started to dry up, then they had to come up with a cool water to save those fish. And one of the things that they did is look at ag water. So the Sacramento Valley agricultural users took some heavy cutbacks at the same time when everybody was saying, well, wait a minute, I drive down the road and I see water on a rice field. So we have had to spend a lot more of our time explaining to the public how the Sacramento Valley is, in fact, a giant bowl. It's a giant watershed. If you put water on a crop in the Sacramento Valley, it goes back into the watershed and heads down to the delta. It may take a little longer, but it does. And in the meantime, we are also a key component of the Pacific Flyway. Ducks, geese, a lot of shore birds come through here and rest in the winter on those same crops that provided food for the rest of the country during the rest of the year. So we have some interesting problems. We did have severe cutbacks. I think the final was about 40% of the rice fields were dormant, which that to me means a lot. It doesn't just mean that there was a farmer that didn't have a crop. There was a tire shop that didn't sell tires to that rice farmer. There was also a bunch of birds, pheasants, quail, that didn't have the refugia that they like around the edge of the field. That went away. There were a lot of impacts to local businesses, local farmers, and in turn, a lot of impact to the people that eat that rice. That rice, the rice from the Sacramento Valley, goes all over the world. And so one of the things that I talk about is, you know, it may be easy to cut back, but somebody's rice bowl is going to be empty because of what my farmers do. And that's the main thing that we try to make people understand, is we're kind of all in this together. It's not just black and white. It's a system that needs some augmentation and needs to have some updates on it, but it's a system that provides food, water for LA, water for municipalities, a tremendous amount of food, rice, wheat, barley, a lot of produce, tomatoes come out of the Sacramento Valley. And in addition, we're also a home to wildlife. So when you talk about cutting back on water, it's not just on water, it's on the whole system when you have to stop feeding those businesses.
Okay. Thanks, Nadine. And we're going to come back to some of those ecosystem interactions when we talk with Brian. But first, I want to turn to Nusha Ajami. Nusha, you deal with the rules of the game, so to speak, you know, the policy questions. And Nadine just said the system needs to be overhauled or updated. So urban to ag to whole scale in some cases. What sorts of policy changes do you think would be appropriate for the state to respond better to these types of circumstances?
Okay. So it's always interesting to hear the ag perspective and urban perspective. The reality is, as you said, we are all in it together. California's settlement trend has been very different from a lot of other states, especially eastern states, because people sort of like to live in, you know, they have been living in the coastal regions and the regions that are not necessarily water rich. So we have built this massive infrastructure to move the water to where people want to live. So this has been a trend, and now we have a lot of this infrastructure now reaching their end of their life, or you know they're having a lot of degradation and challenges. So now it's an opportunity for us to rethink: is that how we want our next generation of infrastructure to look like? Is that where we want to be 50 years from now, having the same kind of challenges? If we build the next dam, build the next aqueduct, how it's going to look like in 50 years? So we do talk a lot about rethinking and reimagining how we have been sort of how we got here and where we want to go. you know, water is a very local and regional issue, depends on the climate that different regions have and the infrastructure that's available to the people in that region. And a lot of the opportunities exist to create local solutions for some of the challenges we are currently facing. David talked about stormwater capture, which is a provides a lot of opportunities to be able to sort of provide some of the, be part of the water supply portfolio that we are having in the future. Think about reuse and recycling of the water. That's another opportunity. The most important one is actually conservation and efficiency. I guess it's a first step, is the cheapest solution, the best one to sort of tap into before we start investing in a lot of other things. It's again, I go back to David's point, LA, I mean, still probably has a long way to go. A lot of water, urban areas have a long way to go to be more efficient in the way they use their water, but they have been trying to be conserve and save water in the past 25 to 30 years, and that had provided additional supply for the future generations. So they have been able to grow within the same amount of water allocations they had using, being able to provide reliable water supplies. Conservation and efficiency provides an opportunity actually for the public to understand what is it that they're using and be more thoughtful about the way they're using it. And there are so many different ways to change people's behavior in that sense. Again, I mentioned reuse and recycling, another sort of solution that's very important. When you think about the state as a whole, I think one of the things we constantly talk about is we need to think about diversifying our water supply portfolios. This diversification can be very, very similar to, renewable energy portfolio. You know, we tell everybody you need to kind of have, we had the rule of 30-30 by 2030, and now actually we have gone to 50% by 2030. Is that, I think 2030 is the target year. And, now you can see the part of our water, energy generation, we have a lot of different options depending on where you are and what opportunities are available in that region. Very similar for water. There are opportunities to deal with, rethinking the way we sort of built these portfolios, diversifying it. And I guess another thing I wanted to mention, and I know Brian is going to talk a little about it as well, it's two things, groundwater and water quality. Every drop of water that you use, it's basically the quality of it degraded, and that needs to be cleaned up and put back to the environment or put back to a system to be reused. So it's really important to protect our water sources. The second thing is groundwater. Groundwater is a hidden resource that we have. We barely think about it because it's not there, and we have not been very thoughtful in the way we sort of use our groundwater. So in a sustainable way. Everything is about, obviously we're all here to live and enjoy life, but we need to be very thoughtful in the way of using our resources in a sustainable way. So a lot of the work that we do at Stanford, at my group, we focus on sustainable water resource management, how to use data to inform policy, how to use research to inform policy, and have an impact-driven policy that focuses on diversifying water supply portfolios, building new information technology or decision support tools that uses a lot of the data that we have to do a better job, but more efficient and effective way of managing the existing systems that we have, and also trying to see how we can diversify that portfolio to include more recycling, reuse, stormwater capture, any local solution that's available within the within different communities.
Okay. Thanks, Nusha. I want to move now to Brian Stranko. If you were on one of the tours yesterday, you might think that the default for California water is sabers drawn, at conflict between all these different interest groups in the state. Brian works with trying to find some common ground between some of these interests to get projects done that have multiple benefits. So, Brian, how do you negotiate between ecosystem interests and farm interests and city interests?
Yeah, well, our experience at the Nature Conservancy is that sabers don't actually work that well to solve problems. And we are all about solving problems, both for people and for nature. What you might not know is the Nature Conservancy is a nonprofit organization. So we have a mission, just like any other nonprofit, and our mission happens to be to try to protect and restore the lands and waters upon which all life depends. And when that comes to water in California, that means we have to be very thoughtful about the people side of the equation as well as the nature side of the equation, and consider how we can kind of stretch every drop and find a balance. And one of the fundamental ways we do that is using science. So there's, for a long time, there's been a bit of a misnomer in the concept of what nature needs in terms of water. We often talk about just getting more water for nature. Well, we need to get specific about it. And when, it turns out when we get specific about it, we actually can find some solutions to farmers having water, cities having water, and nature having water. And the reason why that works is because nature's needs aren't constant when it comes to water. Nature's needs fluctuate across a given year, right? So, for instance, if you think about salmon, salmon are often out in the ocean. So they don't need a whole lot of water flowing down a river when they're out in the ocean. But they do come back to rivers to spawn. And so they absolutely need water in the rivers at the right time so that they can come in and spawn so that new offspring can then take hold. Well, by getting precise about when, for instance, salmon are coming in to our river systems, we can say, hey, why don't we pay some farmers or ranchers to forego irrigating at certain times so that more water is actually flowing down that river system for the few weeks that salmon need them. We've actually been very successful on in the Shasta River Valley, which is in the shadow of Mount Shasta in far northern California, and working with ranchers over the course of this drought to provide water for salmon in four-week periods in the spring, when young salmon want to migrate out to the ocean, and then in the fall, when adult salmon want to come in to spawn. We simply say, hey, we offer to pay you folks a little bit of money if you'll forego irrigating at those times. It gives the ranchers enough time to actually water their pastures, but it also gives enough time for salmon to get through their migration. So it's a pretty good solution. The other example I'll cite is actually with birds in the Central Valley. So migratory birds of the Pacific Flyway, like salmon, are not needing water all the time in California. They're here at certain times a year. They come down from the north and when it gets cold, and they try to find places in California when they want to stop over. And so we try to isolate when the birds are actually going to want to be here. And when we find that out and we get specific about it, we can, very much like the Shasta example, identify 4 to 8 week periods, say in the fall, say in the spring, when we can pay rice farmers to irrigate and flood their fields a little longer than they normally would. That means they get a benefit. That means the birds get the water they need to stop over. And that means we actually get a benefit in water percolating into the ground, into our groundwater. So we're recharging our groundwater supply. These are the type of solutions that we look for. And when we find them, we actually help both our farmers and nature get through pretty hard times during a drought.
I think this is a good point to bring in Nadine and some of the work that the Family Water Alliance has been doing concerning fire and fish, like two things that clearly affect water supplies for farming in the Sacramento Valley.
So in addition to Family Water Alliance, we're also the Sacramento Valley Fish Screen Program. 22 years ago, we started, our founders made a decision not to fight the Endangered Species Act, but to work with it to figure out how we protected fish. So in the last 22 years, we put in 30 screens on the upper Sacramento that keep salmon from going into the ag water that's being pumped from the Sacramento. In addition, now we're also looking at you said protect our water sources. Well, I want to show you a water source. This is the Bagley fire in 2012. So what you see, this is the Lower McLeod River, which is considered a wild and scenic river. Above is the Claiborne Creek. And this was before we had a major rain event in the fall. And what happened is this area burnt very hot. It hadn't been logged. Nothing had happened to it. The fire went in. This forests here are extremely overstocked. We used to have about 60 stems per acre in California forests. Now we have about, in some places, 300 to 400 and 500 stems per acre. That means we have more trees than we historically had. So we had this fire. It came out. There wasn't time enough to get in and do some restoration after the fire. We got this massive rain event, and you can see what it did. This is the whole creek blowing out. That water went into Shasta Dam. So that water came down with its debris and totally changed that whole watershed. We have an issue with our forests that we have to deal with, and simply just locking them up like what we did for the spotted owl hasn't worked. I really applaud the Nature Conservancy's doing some work in Arizona that's getting those downstream water users to pay for some of the thinning and restoration that has to be done. And that does two things. It creates a healthy forest, and it provides jobs for local people, and it keeps some of the water users that wouldn't be able to participate or help, then they are able to get involved and help with that system. And they've done some amazing things. I can't remember the name of the watershed in Arizona, but that one was a massive destruction, even worse than this, where the whole hillside came down into a community. And now they're joining together and getting large water users to help fund some of this. And that's what we're also working on, is protecting our water sources.
And that water from the Sacramento Valley flows into the Delta, and some of it is exported down to L.A., where David is in charge of water supplies. I wanted you to expand a bit about this shift away from imported water in L.A. and what that means in terms of investment and just what it means for local facilities in Los Angeles.
Sure, yeah. The issue is that all the imported water supplies have eroded over time. So if you look in California, especially in Southern California, you've got, I tell people it's three straws in a bathtub. So you have a straw that goes out to the Colorado River, a straw that goes north to the Sacramento and San Joaquin Rivers, you've got a straw that goes to the eastern side of the Sierras to the Owens Valley. Those aqueduct systems have all come under pressure over time. For instance, the Los Angeles aqueduct system. When I first started with the department, we were exporting between 400,000 and 500,000 acre-feet a year through the LA aqueduct system each year. Now we're down in an average year, about 220. During the drought, it was down as low as 60. So on average, about half of the historical water supply from the LA aqueduct system has been reallocated to the environment in the Owens Valley, in the Mono Basin, in the Lower Owens River, Owens Lake. So the water is being used, about half of the historic water is still being used for the environment in the Owens Valley. On the Colorado River, and I will get to the Delta, but on the Colorado River, you have similar problems. The Colorado River has not been in shortage since it originally filled after it was first built. The study now shows, and this was by the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, that this year there won't be a shortage on the Colorado River, but next year the probability of the Colorado River being in shortage for the first time in its history is 40%. And for the following 4 years, that probability jumps up quite a bit. It comes up to 60%. So you've got pretty high probabilities that we're going to be in a shortage on the Colorado. It's not a matter of if, it's just a matter of when. And then on the state side, you look at what's happened with the state system. The state water project has had about a 30% curtailment in deliveries because of some of the fish problems that have happened in the Delta to the smelt and to the salmon. And that has had a pretty big impact on Southern California. So you've heard about the California Water Fix. Some people call it the Twin Tunnel Program. That is a project that is designed to try to keep the water supply from going through the Delta and trying to find a way that you could continue to export water without reversing the flows in some of the rivers in the Delta, which is what occurs when you turn the pumps on in the south of the Delta. And there's thinking that that would be beneficial to the ecosystem and would also secure some of the water supplies. But whether that project gets built or not, Southern California has to start thinking about the fact that local water supply has to be a much bigger portion of our future water supplies. And Southern California is doing that, and it's not just the city of Los Angeles. Of course, I mentioned some of the projects that we're thinking about. We've got a groundwater replenishment project. We're going to be taking advanced treated recycled water and spreading it into our San Fernando Basin. It's kind of an indirect potable reuse project. Of course, I mentioned we've spent $350 million since 1990 on conservation. That is going to continue. So we're going to continue to move the conservation needle as much as we can. And for we have been doing a lot in the area of stormwater. People think that, well, stormwater is a new resource. Water agencies don't even think about it. That's actually not true. In the city of Los Angeles, we capture about 60,000 acre-feet of stormwater a year, and that percolates into our groundwater basin and is pumped out. But our stormwater capture master plan shows a pathway forward for the city to double or triple that amount by 2040. And if you're really interested in stormwater, we got from the American Academy of Environmental Engineers and Scientists last year, gave us their grand prize for excellence in environmental engineering for our stormwater capture master plan. And if you're interested in that master plan, you can see it at ladwp.com/SCMP for stormwater capture master plan. So those are kind of the some of the main initiatives that we're going to do to try to reach these goals that I mentioned to you that the city has set for itself, which is to reduce purchased imported water by 50% by 2025 and to source fully 50% of all the water used in the city locally by 2035. So pretty aggressive goals, and those are some of the initiatives we're going to pursue to try to achieve those goals.
My assumption is that there's going to be a lot of audience interest in questions, so we're going to go to that now. If not, then I can keep asking questions. But the ground rules for this are journalists get first stab at questions. Those are blue name tags. Identify yourself, name and affiliation, and I may repeat the question if I don't think it's loud enough. So questions, Sarah.
Sarah Terry Cobo. I'm an energy reporter with the Journal Record in Oklahoma City. Cover oil and gas, but water and water conservation is always a part of that conversation. So I'm curious, in California, have you folks explored the notion at all of cleaning up brackish saline water that exists underground for non-potable resources or non-potable uses like agriculture or irrigation or cleaning up produced water in oil and gas formations for that same type of purpose?
You can go online. I publish a quarterly newsletter called the Green Ribbon Report, and I can't give you the date, but there's a company called FX.com, and they are doing that. They have a portable desal plant that is right now is designed for tailwater out of agriculture, and it can be built in a way that it's portable, that it can go from farm to farm to farm, but that's in the beginning stages, and that has a lot of potential to take that some of that water that by the time it filters through the farms in Northern California and Southern California, it's pretty salty. And they actually have something that they're doing with that end product. So I've written about that, and I have a better phone number for the guy, too. So I'll post that on my blog, NadineBailey.net, hopefully, if I can get it up.
What was the website?
It's FX.com, I think. But you can get a hold of me at my stuff is all published, so you can go to Green Ribbon and there's a story on our website about the project.
I'll try to touch on that, too. Yeah, we're looking at brackish water desalination in the city of Los Angeles right now, and we've got plans to try to see if we can get an additional water supply from some of the brackish water that does exist in the ground. But we've got two other groundwater initiatives as well that deal with both contaminated groundwater. Our San Fernando groundwater basin has some legacy contamination in it from industry back in the 60s and 70s. Essentially, we've got mostly trichloroethylene, perchloroethylene. We also have 1,4-dioxane. So some of these things we have to clean up. And our impaired groundwater basins aren't the only ones in the state that are impaired. But groundwater remediation and dealing with some of these impairments is really kind of a first step toward people doing things like stormwater capture and recharging groundwater basins with advanced treated recycled water, because it doesn't make a lot of sense to spend a lot of money to capture stormwater and infiltrate it into your groundwater basin, or spend a lot of money to take advanced treated recycled water and spread it into your groundwater basin if you can't pump that groundwater basin because it's contaminated. So this is kind of a first step toward achieving some of those higher goals. So you're absolutely right. I mean, some of these groundwater issues, not only brackish water, but contamination issues throughout the state really need to be addressed before some of the more progressive things that people can do as far as local water supply can be accomplished.
Can I talk mm-hmm. about that? So I'll add, you also asked about produced water. It's still on the table. There are some communities that are considering using some of the oil and gas produced water for agricultural purposes. Some of the regulations were being considered, and there might be a few out. But still, I don't think the economics of it has penciled out yet. So that's also an issue on the table.
We had a question up front.
Yes, I'm John Addison. I write for Media. An agricultural question, but not on the growing, on the grazing. I understand there's over 30 U.S. states with more water per cow than we have, and I've seen numbers as high as 50% of California water for cattle and dairy. I value some different perspectives on any policy pricing recommendations.
Okay. Talk about this a little bit. Actually, I meant to respond. So I don't have the correct percentage, and I think depending on which area of California the grazing is happening, the percentage can be very different. But I think you touched on the pricing part, which is very, very important. I also, you mentioned also about downstream paying for upstream, which is, in California, we have sort of disconnected our population from where their food is coming from, where their water is coming from, where everything is coming from. So nobody really knows what it takes to bring these sources to you. People are not willing to pay more for their water because they don't even know where it's coming from. It's very hard to tell them, look, it takes so much water and resources to grow a cow that for you to eat half of the food that it's on your table and throw the rest of it out. So there's a lot of interconnection between public understanding of what it takes to bring resources to you and their response to, how they react to the scarcity issues we have in the state from water perspective. I think that's...
Well, and then the other thing is people don't think of large grazing animals. California always had large grazing animals, and they reduced fire danger. So especially on public lands, eliminating large grazing animals just makes the grass problem and the brush problem worse. And so then you have to end up paying somebody to come in and remove the grass and the brush. Having cows are kind of like what we used to have with large herds of elk and in the plain states, the buffalo. So we've eliminated the buffalo and the large grazing herds, but cows, and there are some people that are actually using herds of goats. They rent their goats and their sheep out, their brush-eating sheep, and the guy takes them all up and down the western edge of the mountains to graze the brush down to reduce fire danger. So,
right.
And I'll just mention, too, that there's a benefit of grazing compared to some other uses of land when it comes to the natural environment. Grazing can be very compatible with wildlife habitat, and it means that the land hasn't been converted into some hardscape, which has its own negative impacts to our watersheds. That said, grazing can be pretty water wise at times and not so much at other times. So I think what we support is trying to be as responsible as possible, but also recognize that ranching has some great benefits to a lot of things in California.
Thanks. Over here.
I'm Tony Davis. I'm the environmental reporter from the Arizona Daily Star. And I want to ask a question, but I just want to quickly respond in a sentence or two to the last two comments, particularly on the fire. There's really two sides to that story about whether grazing benefits or doesn't benefit fire. I don't want to raise any arguments. I want to ask a question, but I want to point that out, that that's not a settled issue. The question I want to ask is about California's water policy in general. I'd like to get people's comments on this. I know that I don't think most of you are what I would call accountable on the question I'm going to ask, but I'd still be curious to get your comments, which is that this year, when we had El Nino and the drought didn't look so bad, the state lifted a lot of its conservation requirements on cities, and then they had to have goals. And then I read in the Mercury News that the goals were, for a lot of the cities, were zero or very low. And I don't know about Los Angeles. I'm not here to criticize anybody. I'd like to ask what people thought of that and how is that consistent with a sustainable policy, particularly compared to Arizona, which has maintained conservation goals steadily for 30 years.
Okay. Question about urban conservation in the drought.
Well, I guess everybody's looking in my direction. So, we actually haven't lifted our restrictions in the city of LA. So we're still under phase two of our water conservation ordinance. We still have all the prohibited uses in place. We still have 3-day-a-week watering in place. So we haven't taken our foot off the gas on conservation at all. In fact, the mayor, through his sustainable city plan, has set some pretty aggressive future goals for conservation to drive our gallons per person per day use down below 100. So we're still being very aggressive as far as conservation. As far as the state solution is concerned, you know, the state did ask water agencies to pass a stress test. So it was a 3-year drought that you had to show how you would be able to manage through a future 3-year drought. Well, we had quite a bit of rain up in northern part of California this past year, and based on that amount of rain, a good number of water agencies in the state were able to pass a 3-year stress test. So that, including the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California, which is the wholesale water provider for all of Southern California from the 6 counties from Ventura to the Mexican border. They were able to pass a stress test, and because they were able to pass it, all their member agencies were able to also pass a stress test. So, but the state didn't stop there. I mean, the state is moving forward with some permanent conservation regulations. It's moving forward with those now. I'm actually on the urban advisory group that works on those. And they're going to have some prohibited uses in this state that are going to be all across the state of California, will be in place at all times. They're also going to put forward some shortage criteria where member agents, all water agencies are going to have to take actions during various levels of shortage. And then they're also going to adopt some efficiency standards, which are going to require, for instance, like 55 gallons per person per day for indoor water use. And other efficiency standards are going to be adopted as well. So, yes, there are many agencies in the state that were able to pass the 3-year stress test, but I think the state of California and its efforts in the area of water use efficiency are going to be pretty robust. And I think when you see these permanent conservation regulations that the state board and the Department of Water Resources and many of the water agencies around the state are working on, you'll be impressed with what they come up with.
So when David was talking earlier, he mentioned the decoupling of their price, the rate. And that is key. One of the biggest problems California's water agencies have been facing, especially medium to small. So California has about 2,000 water utilities. There are some large ones like, you know, LADWP, SFPUC, and there are many medium to small size ones that they don't necessarily have a lot of resources available to them to figure out how to change their rate setting process, how to cover all their costs properly. And, you know, it's just that it requires a big, I mean, you guys have a big finance department that deals with that whole issue of pricing and rate setting and all that. So when I said all these things to say, a lot of these water agencies, they sell a gallon of water to you to recover the cost of the service they provide. And if they're not selling that gallon of water, that means that they're short a gallon of water to cover the cost of the services they provide. So often people forget that we don't necessarily pay for water. Water as a resource is free. You're paying for the services that's provided to you. And those services require operation and maintenance and requires a lot of people to make sure that cleaning that water, energy that requires to clean that water, energy that requires to bring it to your door. So there are like so many costs associated to get that water to that tap. And if the water agency cannot properly separate this fixed cost of delivering water to people from the cost, the variable rates that they have, then they're going to have a hard time to recovering that cost. So some of these water agencies, even though they said they passed the stress test, and, you know, honestly, I can't really comment on that because I didn't really look at every single water agency. I think it was also the fact that they have been under so much financial stress because people have been not using as much water in the past few years, and they have been really having problem recovering the costs.
And there was one estimate of about $500 million in revenue loss for California right. utilities from the drought. Someone from the back. Yes.
Brendan Gibbons, Cover Water for the San Antonio Express News. David, you mentioned a groundwater replenishment project. Is that the same as what we in Texas call aquifer storage and recovery? And so how many acre feet do you think you can store in the first 10 years in California? Is that a current project or is it going in right now?
We're working on it. It's not in right now. There are projects like it in California. In particular, Orange County Water District has a GWR project. It's not an ASR project, as you mentioned. Those are typically conjunctive use projects where you're not injecting advanced treated recycled water into the ground, although you could do that. But it is a project that's going to be in the San Fernando Valley, and you asked about the volume. Our plan is to advance treat 30,000 acre feet of recycled water from our Donald C. Tillman Water Reclamation Plant, advance treat that water 30,000 acre feet, spread it into our San Fernando groundwater basin, and then that, of course, that water will flow through the basin to our wells, and we'll pump it and serve it to the public.
Jenny? Or Robin, sorry.
My name is Robin Meadows. I freelance, and one of the things I cover is water in California. And what I'd like to know from each of you, or whoever would like to answer, is are there any promising water solutions for California that are not in place that you would like to try or see somebody try?
I have one. So our Central Valley system was built on, you know, 60, 70 years ago on the premise that we would get heavy snowpack in the winter, and then that would slowly trickle into the reservoirs that we have currently. But what is happening now is even though in the drought years we had significant rainfall that came in the form of warm rain, and we had no way to capture that with our existing system. So what our organization is supporting is Building Sites Reservoir. It's between Sacramento and Redding, up in the foothills west of I-5, and it will allow some of that water that is currently just going in those big, large spring storms to be captured and then used for both benefits for fisheries, for the cold water pool. It will allow a greater flexibility, and it meets that criteria for the governor's water plan about how we plan for climate change and all of those things. So that's probably what I spend 50% of my time on.
And reservoirs are one of those always contentious issues yes. in California that not everyone agrees with.
And this is not a dam. This is an off-stream storage. So it does not dam up a fish, because I'm also a fish person too. So this meets the criteria of being off-stream and not impacting fisheries.
There are a couple fundamental things that these are not new ideas I'm going to mention right now, and not really innovative either. But they're things we've talked about for decades, drought after drought. First of all, comprehensively measuring and monitoring our water system. We don't do that very well. In fact, we're doing it less well than we have in the past. I'll give you one statistic. There are 1,500 U.S. Geological Survey stream gauges in California. Only 500 of those are active today. That's kind of a problem. When we want to try to figure out how much water needs to go to people and how much water goes to nature, we're not measuring. We can't manage for that. So that to me, if fundamentally we did one thing, that would probably be it. The second thing is we haven't spoken that much about groundwater yet today. Groundwater in California, because of our geology, is a massive, massive resource for us. But it was only 2014, that we established rules for the first time in most of California around groundwater management. In fact, that was just putting the rules down. We haven't implemented that. There's a very long timeline to implement, but we are getting behind every day. During a drought, we rely far more on groundwater than we do during regular years. So we really have to expedite implementation of our new groundwater rules so that we can do a better job of being sure during droughts we can rely on that sustainably.
Now, I'll break in here. There's a whole panel on groundwater in California this afternoon. So that can be a tease for it. If you have more questions, go to Erica's panel.
Had to mention it.
I'll go a different direction. I totally agree with Brian. First, I wanted to mention data. Data, not just measuring our resources, which is very important. We are not really doing a very good job in collecting a lot of data. We also are very data-rich, knowledge-poor, so we have a lot of data that we don't take advantage of to inform what we do. So I give you a very simple example that we are actually working on right now. All the water that you use, it's collected through meters. We know who uses what. I mean, not we, but the agencies, obviously. That information can be used to understand how people respond to different factors, such as, price, such as land use, such as different demographics that exist. We are actually doing a study which a complement to the media, which we are sort of trying to see how media has been impacting the water use change in California, which actually have been very significant. The amount of coverage during the drought have sort of spiked so high, and people have been responding to that significantly. So understanding all these things require using that data to kind of inform us what is going on, and that can be very different from Los Angeles to Bay Area to Central Valley, very, very different. So, and that information can be used to do a better job of understanding how much water do we need in the future. So there's something called demand forecasting, which every agency does to kind of decide what kind of projects do they need to implement in the future. And if they don't have a very good knowledge of where their demand is going, they're not going to necessarily invest their capital wisely. Give you an example. As David said, Los Angeles have been sort of having using less than what they used to right now. And traditionally, the way that we looked at the demand was population is growing. For every single person that comes into the pool, you need X amount of water. So that means that as population grows, we need more supply. Now, when you look at how people's behavior are changing, you can actually see maybe if you focus on the demand side and see where the demand is going and manage demand, you may not even need as much of a big solution of a big reservoir, an aqueduct, or any of those anymore. You might actually be happy just to do stormwater capture or green infrastructure or like this smaller local solutions and can invest your money on those. So I think that is that data, using data to inform decision making is very important.
I'm going to make this real quick. I think one thing that is really innovative that's out there that's a real low-hanging fruit for the state is direct potable reuse. So the regulations aren't there in place right now, but you look at the state of Texas, they do it. You look at the country of Singapore, they do it. What it is that you advance treat the recycled water, and then instead of doing a groundwater replenishment project where you're spreading it into the local groundwater basin, you take that advanced treated water and you use it as a source water for your treated water drinking plants. So it would go upstream as a raw water source that goes into the filtration plant that serves the drinking water distribution system. I think that is probably one of the things that will happen in the state of California within the next decade or so. I think it will be a game changer as far as water supply is concerned, because right now we're importing water from hundreds of miles away. We use it one time, we dump it into the ocean. It really doesn't make a lot of sense. But the way that you can really maximize the use of recycled water is if you can get direct potable reuse regulations in place.
And the state is working on regulations for direct potable reuse right now. Yes, in the back over here.
Yes, hi. Mark Shapiro. I'm a freelance journalist and teach at Journalism at Berkeley. And I'm writing about seeds right now. So, first of all, very interesting discussion, and I was just wondering, if the National Climate Assessment talks about essentially the Southwest, Southern California being one of the most directly impacted by climate change, rising temperature, diminishing rainfall, huge amounts of studies being done about the incredible unpredictability of the rainfall. We can't even forecast. I mean, to some extent, you can't even forecast 10, 20 years ahead. So, what would you tell a farmer? So 50 years ago or something, people came to the Central Valley, vast country immigrants came from all over the world to farm in California. And to some extent, they could be guaranteed a decent livelihood back in Central Valley or in southern Arizona. And now, I'm just curious how you would interpret the phenomena that we're now experiencing, you're talking about, when it comes to agriculture.
A question?
The question is, are the nature of foods changing? What would you say to a farmer who by accident inherited or bought land in the Central Valley today about their prospects for 40 years? Get out of agriculture, do something else, what?
The big question, Ed, what's the future of ag in California?
I'll say something and I'll let you go. So, you know, people have been farming forever and ever. I mean, you go to sort of southern European countries, they were like generation after generation, they were doing agriculture and they're still okay. They have this, their soil is healthy, their water is okay. I think it's the key is being a sustainable farmer. And I think one of the challenges we are having right now in California, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is this new trend of people who are not necessarily farmers by trade. They just come in, they buy land, and they want to make money. And I actually personally knew a few of those who have MBAs from, you know, Ivy League, and decided to grow almonds and make money. And they're making a lot of money. But they don't care because this is a short-term thinking. Agriculture, if it is it's a real trade. Should be a long-term thinking. You know, you need to care about your soil, about your water, about what you grow, about the fact that you want to hand off this land to the next person to be able to grow it. So this is my perspective on farming. But
okay, so that brings up, and I hope no one's filming this, but in the original Central Valley Compact, there was a rule that water from the Central Valley Project could only go on to farmer-owned land, that you had to own the land in order to be able to get that water from the Central Valley Project, because they wanted to protect those small farmers and keep it in that sustainable manner. And the other thing that was not supposed to happen is there were never supposed to be permanent crops planted, because the people that designed the Central Valley Project understood that droughts would occur. And if you want to see it, I have all of those documents. I'll load them up so that you can read them yourself. And so that is one of the problems, is we've strayed, and now we're paying the price for it. And one of the reasons that my farmers are so flexible is because they're tied five and six generations to that land. They just didn't come in last week, and they're gonna economize, they're gonna sacrifice because they want to pass it on to their children. And you see those people in the San Joaquin Valley coming forward now to say, I don't want to fight about fish. I don't want to kill the fisherman's job in order to save mine. Those are the people that we need to reach out and empower. Those are the people that, instead of just broad brushing all farmers as bad and water users, we need to connect with those people that want to be on that land generationally, because that's what protects us all. So that's my soapbox.
Just one very question from myself. Very simple yes or no answer. Does California continue to have 7 or 8 million irrigated acres of farmland 10, 20 years from now? A hard pass from everyone.
I don't think so.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's basically my question. Is that, you know, we've heard a lot about California having decreasing available water, and we're at the same time producing a significant percentage of the nation's food. That's a disproportional use of resources. Is there any sort of long-term planning for how to support local?
Okay, so that is a thing with me. Go out. I'm sorry. I have a little farm. I have 20 walnut trees and about a half an acre of garden. And I'm telling you right now, you can't, an individual cannot feed themselves. We eat and we don't have food lines because of big agriculture. And I know it's not popular right now, but when you go home, look through your grocery store, and you're going to see a lot of the vegetables and fruit come from here. That's not a bad thing. Because of California, people aren't starving to death anymore. And I don't want to see that go away. I want to look for solutions to make sure that we can be sustainable no matter how big our ag is.
Yes.
Laurel Rogers with the U.S. Geological Survey.
First, journalists get, journalists get first stab. Any other journalists with questions?
Dennis Cuff of the Bay Area News Group. One of the offbeat things that happened in the drought among some of the urban water agencies in the East Bay is the water and sewer agencies started opening these recycled water fill stations where they said, come to us, we'll give you free recycled water. But you're going to have to drive it, you're going to have to pick it up, you're going to have to go take it home, and you're going to have to deliver it. It's very popular, thousands of people did it, and somewhat to the surprise of the agencies, when the steep drought rates were pulled off, people kept coming. So don't close it, keep it coming. Even though some of the people in the agencies are saying, this doesn't seem to make sense economically at all. But you want it, and we want to encourage recycling.
Question?
Doing. The question is basically, is this just a weird day or a trend or even will go on?
So self-serve recycled water stations?
Yes. Okay. There's a little oversight. The agency helps people fill up. But there's several of them that sprung up. There's half a dozen, almost a dozen.
So I'm a governor appointee to the Regional Water Quality Board in Bay Area. And this was told, they told us they're doing this, and we were absolutely amazed by different information that was coming because, you know, it's amazing how informative all these efforts have been. People would come in and they would think that they can take, I don't know, this many gallon of water with their normal car, and they couldn't believe how heavy this water is, and the fact that they can't take it with them. So I think from my perspective, it's great if it goes on because that has been very informative for people to understand water and where it's coming from and what it takes and how it goes. And it may go on. And don't forget, the drought is not over. We had a below-average year last year. It wasn't even an average year. And whatever snow we got, was melted before even we had time to count it. So it was not a very wet, it wasn't a wet year, it was a below average year, and we're still in a drought, and there's no guarantee next year we're going to even get this much rain. So even with the drought you know, restriction being lifted and trying to change the approach to it and all that, still we are trying to understand the fact that, you know, we might be in this for a long time. So whatever is going on, it's better keep it for now.
David?
We have one recycled water fill station currently. We're about to open a second one, and you're absolutely right. I mean, it's something that the public does want, and we find that it's an excellent way to educate the public on the safety and proper use of recycled water. So people become familiar with recycled water, they experience recycled water, they're able to use it to irrigate their gardens or their property, and it really helps this perception problem that recycled water has had in the past. And so we don't see it as a way to really use a lot of recycled water. It's a very small amount of recycled water used. Still, most of our recycled water in the city is moved through our Purple Pipe program, and then, of course, we want to do the GWR program. But this is really kind of almost a public outreach effort when you do these type of fill stations. The problem with essentially getting recycled water into homes is you have a cross-connection issue that you have to really be careful about, because you know, the public water agency is not responsible for the pipes on the customer's side of the meter. So if you start delivering recycled water, there has to be a dual plumbing system in. Dual plumbing tends to be very expensive. I really think that purple pipe is, you're going to find in 10 to 15 years, water systems won't be building purple pipe anymore. We're building currently a purple pipe system in our downtown recycled water system. The existing purple pipe systems will be maintained, but once you have direct potable reuse regulations in place, it's going to essentially make purple pipe systems a bit of a buggy whip in a way, because now you're going to be able to advance treat that water and use it as a source water, and you can put it right through your treatment plant and into your distribution system. So there's no need for a separate distribution system through purple pipe or dual plumbing in buildings to use it. And that's really, I think, the wave of the future.
Okay. Well, we're going speed round here. We have a hard stop at 12:15. So one question, one response. Next here.
We've got a lot of similar solutions to some farm versus fish water issues, and people are really coming together around solutions. The problem is, who should be paying for things like paying farmers to give their water to fish, paying for new off-channel reservoirs? Where do you guys think the long-term funding comes from for these solutions?
Other people.
Real quick, I'm at... I think there's going to have to be a combination of financing for it. I think, first of all, we have to find ways for those types of programs to actually pay off so we get investment in them. And then secondly, I think our public, the way we deal with financing from our public system right now doesn't allow for that many flexible programs like that. So we need to redesign how we finance things from a public perspective. For instance, water bonds, they're not going to help you pay for short-term water leases. So there's a lot of thinking around how you might do that, but it's going to take some dismantling of some pretty complex constraints that we have on our system. We're not allowed to do a lot of rate fee charges, for instance, in California, because our hands are tied from rules that we put in place in the past. But we're going to have to really reconsider that and make some changes so that we can fully finance our water system.
Can I plug in for something?
10 seconds. I'll break my rule.
We have a report on innovative financing mechanisms that you can use for multi-purpose water projects, and I'll be happy to send it to you.
In the back. Erica.
Yeah, thanks for the question. So first of all, those short-term programs aren't a panacea. They are an augment to more permanent protections, because you need some, for instance, for water, you need some baseline of water at all times for the environment. Those programs, though, what we call dynamic conservation, because they're dynamic programs, they help to share what water is around across human and wildlife uses. And so they therefore are quite useful during a drought, because that's when we get into most competition. And it's all really all about timing and about creatures which use water at different times of year for different things.
Yes.
Sure. Neil Strassman, formerly the Star Telegram in Fort Worth, Freelancer now. Somewhere around 15% of the finished product doesn't reach the tap of the systems. It's a huge national water infrastructure issue. Are there any innovative solutions?
Yeah, I think the first thing, and you'll see this in California, there are going to be some, as part of these conservation regulations come out, there are going to be some mandates for water agencies to do water loss audits of their systems. Now, we recently, last year, we did a full water loss audit and component analysis of our entire water system for the city of Los Angeles for the first time in our history. We'd come under a lot of criticism. People were saying, well, you know, if you just fixed all the leaky pipes, you probably wouldn't need to import any water, you'd be fine. So we did this study. What we found was that our total lost water in the system, unaccounted water, was about 6%. And the losses due to leakage in the system were about 3.5%. So we have a very tight system. And, you know, the difference is, you know, you have some unaccounted water that you use for fire flows, flushing flows, there's evaporative losses, there's theft, but then you have leaks in your pipes that you need to address. And so those are really effective in making it clear to water agencies not only how much leakage they have, but how to go about addressing that leakage. And we recently adopted a water loss action plan. And even though we have a fairly tight system, when you're delivering 514,000 acre feet a year, a few percent is a lot of water. So we're going to go after that water through this action plan. And I think you'll see more of those water loss audit and component analysis studies done, especially in the larger water systems throughout the state, because it's a very economical way, and you get a pretty big bang for your buck as far as water, the cost of an acre foot of water.
All right. That's all we have. 12:15, thank you everyone on the panel. It's been great.